Can you people hear the question? Okay. If you can't, let me know and I'll repeat it.
Can you repatriate the money, or should I say patriate the money? Taxable. However, would taxable income to, say, whoever got involved in this activity? However, if the principal of the foreign corporation were to borrow the money from the foreign corporation, would that not be a legal way to avoid taxation?
Could you repatriate the earnings of the corporation through a loan to the U.S. shareholder? My initial reaction to that is yes, you could, if it was a bona fide loan. But there is a provision, you see, these controlled foreign corporation rules, I hate to speak at all about them without having the code in front of me. There is a provision under the deemed dividend theory that says, for example, investments in U.S. property. Yeah, I know, but I'm just wondering whether there's also a little subsection there that says loans to U.S. shareholders. You know, about I can't give you a definite answer without having the code in front of me to see whether that is one of the kinds of things that is considered as a dividend. If it's not there, if it's not specifically listed, and I'll be glad to tell you tomorrow if you'd like. If it's not specifically listed, then I would say as long as it was a bona fide loan, it would be okay, subject to all the rules that apply to loans between shareholders and corporations, which are sometimes treated as salary, and sometimes they're treated as loans, and sometimes they're treated as dividends.
Borrow the money from a foreign bank.
Certainly you could. I just earlier a gentleman asked me about investing in U.S. real estate through a controlled foreign corporation, and I said, well, no, you'd be taking a chance that would be considered carrying on a trade or business in the U.S. As a result of his question, I have just remembered that another kind of income, which is subject to the deemed dividend theory, is the investment in U.S. property by a controlled foreign corporation. So the answer to his question is no, you cannot use a controlled foreign corporation to invest in real estate in the United States. Yes, sir?
You said that you couldn't invest in commodities in the U.S., but I wasn't clear on whether or not you could invest with the controlled corporation in commodities outside the U.S., whether that was.
Outside the U.S., no problem. Anything that you do with your foreign corporation, well, anything, you could not invest in commodities futures outside the U.S. or anywhere. Commodities futures is investment income, as is gain on stock bought on the Paris Bourse or interest paid by a Dutch bank. It's all investment income, and government doesn't really care where it comes from, U.S. or otherwise. Commodities themselves, if you're buying gold and you're reducing it to your possession, I would say that's not a commodities future, although I don't think there are any cases on it. I think that's personal property, merchandise, and you can do that as long as you keep out of the U.S. Yes, sir? Could you speak up a little bit, please? That's right. Just recently, last year, or I guess in 1976, within the last couple of years, Congress passes so many tax bills these days, I can't keep them all straight. Recently, they lowered the capital gains tax from a maximum of, 35% to 28%. It used to be you'd take your capital gain, put half in your pocket, and the other half would be taxable at the normal individual income tax rates. Now you can take 60% of your capital gain and put it in your pocket, and the other 40% is just taxable at the normal tax rates, at the ordinary income tax rates. They considered themselves as doing something about the problem you just described when they did that. They lowered the capital gains rates. The capital gains tax is supposed to recognize the fact that capital gains are taxed at a lower rate is supposed to be a recognition of the fact that when you buy a piece of property and hold it for a long time, unless your property has appreciated in value faster than inflation, you haven't really made any money on it. That's why they tax, that's one of the reasons why they tax capital gains at a lower rate. There have been bills introduced in Congress which would permit you to adjust your basis in your capital assets for inflation. Every year, you would look at what the CPI or whatever index they'd want to use was, and you would increase your basis in your capital asset by that percent. So that theoretically, if your asset just appreciated at the same rate as inflation, you'd never have to pay a tax when you sold, because as your basis goes up, the amount of taxable gain goes down, gain being the difference between what you sell for and your basis. There was a lot of support for that, but it would be a terrible drain on the federal revenue. If you want to know the truth, I mean, that's why the bill didn't pass, because the government just can't afford to give away revenue like that. You would lose. You know, I mean, the law is clear. There are a lot of tax cases where people do take positions like that. There are a lot of tax cases where people say that the income tax is unconstitutional because people don't get paid in silver certificates anymore. These people have, they've never won a case. Yes, sir.
Sir, I know there's a ruling on this, but I wonder about your opinion. Where a man sells a piece of property and realizes capital gain, as the man said over here, except that he sells it for bags of silver, that face value would show no gain at all. Maybe sell at the same price as his cost basis, but in present worth of those bags of silver would be much higher. Does he realize a... The government has not litigated this, and really what I'm asking is, are you familiar with it? And two, what would be your opinion about whether or not they would litigate it, in view of the fact that they'd be going against their own currency and their own constitutional provisions about the currency?
I think I follow you on silver. As you know, there is no tax on what is called a like-kind exchange. That's the exchange of one kind of investment property for the same kind of investment property, but a different actual physical piece of property. I don't think that a building... Pardon me?
This would be unlike.
This would certainly be unlike.
Right.
So therefore, if there was any gain realized, I should think it would be taxable.
My question...
And I can guarantee that the IRS would litigate it.
Well, if they haven't yet... Theory that to do so would be to say that those pre-1965 silver coins are not currency. They are currency. They would have to take the position that they're not currency and therefore a commodity.
They have a private vote.
There's a ruling on it, but I noticed that there's been no litigation, no taxes, and I think it's because IRS can't afford to.
Well, that could be. I'm not familiar with the ruling. And what you're saying could be true. I don't know. I wouldn't try it with something other than silver coins, though.
That's the only thing you can do it with.
I would think so.
365 silver coins.
Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Maybe it would be possible when you redeem the silver coins.
I think the cost basis would be transferred to the coin.
Cost basis would carry over, and you'd recognize the full gain at the time.
Could you exchange sovereigns for Kruger Rands or Kruger Rands for sovereigns?
I would say that's like-kind property, and I think there may be a ruling to that effect. Yeah. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, it depends on the kind of foreign corporation. If you have a foreign personal... Oh, the question was, how does the IRS decide how much the deemed dividend should be? When they are pretending that you're receiving a dividend from your foreign corporation, how do they decide how much of that is actually a taxable dividend? In the case of foreign personal holding companies, it is merely the taxable income of the corporation. With a foreign personal holding company, they're saying, as far as we're concerned, your company is just, it's a sham, and we're just going to disregard it, and we'll calculate its taxable income, and that's the dividend. In the case of a controlled foreign corporation, however, you've raised a good point. In the case of a controlled foreign corporation, the amount of the deemed dividend is limited to the amount of the corporation's earnings and profits. Like any dividend, it's taxable only if it's paid out of E&P. So in the case of a controlled foreign corporation, the IRS would calculate the amount of E&P. That's accumulated and current E&P, earnings and profits, and that would put a limit on the amount of the dividend. And sometimes you can get money out of a foreign corporation by bringing it out in a year when you haven't got any E&P, earnings and profits. Yes, sir?
Well, I think, getting back to the silver, I think it was really worrying the IRS when silver was at $50, but since they pulled this thing on the hunt and it's dropped so dramatically, I think it's not... It's kind of saved the IRS from going in and challenging them.
That could be, yeah. Yes, sir?
In this example that you gave in the earlier station of the doctor who set up the foreign corporation, again, does he have to qualify with these 11 shareholders or one foreign shareholder?
No, he didn't have to do that. He was conceding. He was saying, here I am, I'm a controlled foreign corporation. I own all the stock. Okay? He wasn't a foreign personal holding company because he wasn't earning any foreign personal holding company income. No investment income. Or he had some investment income, but he didn't get up to 60% of his corporation's gross income being investment income, so he wasn't a foreign personal holding company. He was a controlled foreign corporation, but he didn't care because the deemed dividend theory didn't apply to the kind of income that his company was making. It did apply to the dividends and interest that he was earning on the money that he reinvested, but it didn't apply to the control to the earnings on the sale of the equipment, and he was bringing that dividend and interest back to the United States at the corporate tax rates. Some of it at the corporate tax rates.
If there were foreigners who have a corporation and they invest funds in the United States into CDs and things like that, is that not completely tax-free to them?
Well, when foreigners invest in the U.S., they become subject to withholding taxes.
Corporations.
Foreign corporations are also subject to withholding taxes on investments in the U.S.
Let's say it's a Cayman corporation, where that Cayman corporation, that there's no taxation at Cayman. You're saying that the United States is going to tax that foreign corporation on dividend income?
It's going to tax that foreign corporation on dividends earned in the United States. That's right. What usually happens with true foreign corporations, they incorporate in countries that have favorable tax treaties with the U.S. Under most tax treaties between countries, there is a provision which says that the rate of withholding, the rate of tax on investment type income earned in the U.S. will be 5% instead of 30%, which is the statutory rate. So these corporations go into favorable tax treaty countries, and that's where they generate their investment income in the U.S. Yes, sir?
Can you tell us about the so-called this tax shelter that's a contract on art where you make a purchase and they have the original art and they make prints and it goes over 2 or 3 years?
Well, you know the revenue ruling number on that one? No, I'm sorry. There was a revenue ruling issued. It was the Christmas present for Jackie Fine Arts, who is one of the major promoters of these lithographic plate deals, in which you buy a lithographic plate, which entitles you to run off 200 or 300 prints, whatever the contract says. An appraiser comes in and says, well, this lithographic plate, in view of the fact that the owner can produce 200 or 300 prints, this lithographic plate is worth $300,000, let's say $1,000 a print. And you can buy these things for $20,000 or $30,000 down, sign a partially recourse note, a recourse note for another $20,000 or $30,000, and you also sign a non-recourse note. A non-recourse note is a note that you don't have to pay back if you don't want to. And you can satisfy both the recourse note and the non-recourse note by giving back the lithographic plate to the person who sold it to you. So in effect, all you've got to lose is your $30,000. It's not quite that simple, but that's basically how the lithographic plate art shelters work. And around December 29th, the Internal Revenue Service published a ruling which said that it looks to us as though you're only at risk for $30,000, therefore you can only deduct $30,000 in losses or depreciation or whatever. Now, a lot of times, you know, these tax shelters will come, you know, out of nowhere. People you've never heard of, accounting firms you've never heard of, law firms you've never heard of. Jackie Fine Arts was put together by some reputable people, and they had reputable accountants, and they had a Park Avenue law firm in New York, right, the opinion of counsel. The IRS just about destroyed the shelter with its revenue ruling, but the facts weren't quite the same. They changed the facts just a little bit. So it's not clear the status of these art tax shelters right now is not clear, because the revenue ruling was so clearly intended to get to Jackie Fine Arts, but didn't quite go all the way. It's sort of symbolic of the way the IRS is attacking these tax shelters. A lot of these speculative tax and shelters these days. It's scare tactics. Nobody's going to invest in Jackie Fine Arts anymore. Even if the lawyers immediately put out a letter that said the facts in the revenue ruling are not the same as the facts under which we operate. Well, you know, it's easy for the lawyers to say that, but it's hard for the investors to believe it. I don't know where lithographic plates are. I personally have a problem with them when you can turn back the lithographic plate and have the loan canceled. You know, I don't know where I come out on that. If the lithographic plate is in fact worth a couple of $100,000, then if you give it up in return for the cancellation of your loan, it seems to me that's a perfectly legitimate business transaction if that's what you decide you want to do. It all comes down to a question of valuation. If the lithographic plate is only worth, you know, $25,000 and you give it up in return for the cancellation of a $300,000 loan, that doesn't sound like a bona fide business investment. And it's always coming down to valuation, and the only place these issues are going to be decided is in the courts, because the IRS has a panel of art advisors which tells them what art is worth, but it's not the business of the IRS to determine once and for all what the value of a lithographic plate is, and it's not my business either. And eventually, somebody is going to get one of these cases into the tax court, and then we'll start to see what can be done and what cannot be done in this area. Yes, sir?
Question on the Jackie situation. Would there not be recapture if the investor had given back the plates and paying off the loan?
Recapture of accelerated depreciation? Yeah, but what they were contemplating was that they would give back those plates after 5 or 6 years, at which time the amount of depreciation you would have claimed under the straight line method would begin to approximate the amount you already claimed under the accelerated method, and there would be no recapture, or little recapture. They probably kept them, you see, it was 7 years, so that they wouldn't also recapture the investment tax credit. Yeah.
I thought you were semi-precious.
They
just pulled
that around on that. Jewels. What do they say about that? They want you to depreciate jewels, right?
No, it's where you buy them and you donate them at a much higher value.
Oh, yeah, right. You buy, it doesn't have to be jewels, something, they do it with books, too. You buy any commodity at wholesale, they're buying them. And then people are, sometimes they're holding them for a year, sometimes they're just turning around and donating them to a charity the next day. And they're donating to the charity at what they consider to be the fair market value. And the IRS is coming, and so they're buying for $10, donating for $50. They're getting a $50 deduction, which is saving them $25 in taxes. Their cost was $10. They've come out $15 ahead of the game. Well, the fact is, if they wanted to, they could go right back the next day and buy some more of those gems for $10. So the IRS comes along and says, how can you say that these things have a fair market value of $50 when you can buy them from this guy again and again for $10? And, you know, I have trouble combating that argument. A lot of times the IRS isn't right, I think, about valuation, but when people are giving away things for $50 that they can buy the same time for $10, it would be hard to convince a tax court, I think, that that merchandise had a fair market value of $50. I wouldn't know how to argue it.
If you had some outstanding appraisers for the finance
of the country, Jackie Fine Arts had the most outstanding appraisers in the country. The IRS is only impressed by its own appraisers. But, you know, again, I don't know how you'd fare when you got to court. I'd rather take a Jackie Fine Arts case to court than a gem donation case. Yes, sir?
You have a privately held foreign bank, Franklin's. You consider that the same as a personal holding company?
No, there are special rules that apply to foreign banks. If you're going into the banking business, it's not quite so difficult to escape U.S. taxation. I don't happen to know those rules off the top of my head. I know that foreign banks are usually excluded from most of the rules which end up taxing U.S. shareholders on foreign corporations. You cannot invest, right?
Invest in U.S. dollars, unless you're $0 market or the Amsterdam market. Not the United States to get my treasury.
Right.
By any passive U.S. instruments.
You mean if you do, you will not only be subject to the withholding tax, but your bank itself will be coming subject to U.S. taxing jurisdiction? Yeah. Anybody want to start a bank? Yes, sir.
You said in there about the companies that are not deemed, not applicable to the deemed dividend.
Right.
Being a type that sells products overseas. If that particular corporation decides to do business in the United States, does it automatically come under the jurisdiction for all of its income?
No, only for the income attributable to the activities carried on in the U.S. Yes, sir. Good point. I mentioned those rules where relatives are considered as owning stock owned by other relatives. If you had 11 shareholders, each owning 9.9% of the stock, and if you and your spouse were two of those shareholders, then you would have one shareholder with 19% of the stock. They add together stock owned by related people. Spouses, children, parents, and siblings. Siblings, brothers, and sisters. They add all the stock owned by those kinds of people together and treat it as being owned by one person. So if you and your spouse and your five kids each owned 9.9% of a stock of a corporation, that corporation would be a controlled foreign corporation because that family would own more than 50% of it. It would be considered as one taxpayer.
What if you were divorced from your wife officially?
Then you're not related to your wife, and that's okay.
Why?
No, there's no question about that. The law is specific. It says spouses. It doesn't say ex-spouses.
If the wife has possession of the kids and they own part of the stock.
The law says kids. Doesn't say who are they living with. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, I thought you in the meeting, I thought you said though that you could own 40%
sure.
The rest divided.
Sure.
And with your family.
Exactly, sure. You and your family could each own 9.9%. You and the four members of your family could each own 9.9% of that corporation. That would come to about 45%. And you're not yet a controlled foreign corporation.
Well,
and if all
I thought you meant I could own 40 and my rest of my family could own the other 60%.
No, they add together all the stock owned by all family members. Yeah. Anything else?
One last question.
Yes, sir.
Could you set up a foreign corporation with a foreign citizen? 50-50%. The loan money in this country, in the United States, so that the company, the United States corporation, could legitimately deduct the interest payment from his income tax, but the interest paid to the foreign corporation, let's say Cayman, where you're only 50-50 with the Netherlands bank or something, and not have any income tax on the interest income abroad.
Yes, I would say you could do that. Once your foreign corporation is more than 50% controlled, pardon me?
Would it be 50-50 or 51-49?
No, it's more than 50%. If it was 50-50, you're okay. You have to have more than 50% control in a U.S. shareholder.
So you could then legitimately build up money in your foreign corporation with a deduction on the state side and no income tax on the foreign side.
That's right. Now, under those circumstances, there's no way the government can get at your corporation, but it can still get at you. But there wouldn't be much you could do. It might try to say, well, this corporation is lending money to you at very low interest rates, so we are going to impute a little more interest to you.
So as long as you're getting the deduction...
As long as your corporation overseas is getting the deduction, it wouldn't make any difference. That's right.
The same set of facts, piggybacking on it, would it be all right if that stateside corporation was 50% owned by the same foreign citizen that owned 50% of your Cayman corporation?
I don't see how that would make any difference.
No difference.
Mm-mm. As long as he wasn't your brother.
Right.
Yes, sir.
If you have a foreign corporation, let's say you have 10 people together, and then a year later you decide that 10 people want to go their own way, and then you take, let's say, those funds to form another corporation, 10 more people, are you ever taxed on that or not?
Good question.
What would it
The question is, suppose you had you and 10 other people owning a foreign corporation, and then it came to pass that those people were no longer interested, so the corporation was dissolved, and another foreign corporation was started. If you did it that way, there would be no problem. Same funds, it wouldn't matter. You'd have a different corporate entity.
What I'm getting at is, what if you want to set up a business, and you want to have, you invest overseas, and you get 10 partners, and you, let's say you do it for a year, you have the 10 partners together, then what happens is you just put in a contract at the end of the year, we'll dissolve this, because some people may want to go one place and others want to go somewhere else. So you dissolve it, and the following year you start it up again, another 10 or maybe the same 10.
Yeah, when the problem with that, here's the problem with it. When you dissolved it, you would have a liquidation distribution. Even if you never really brought the money back to the United States for tax purposes, you would have a right to get your hands on that money as one of the shareholders at the time of dissolution. And there are the standard tax laws that apply to dissolutions of corporations would come into effect. It might be ordinary income if there was earnings and profits, or it might be a capital gain. It wouldn't be a capital gain. There's a rule on the dissolution of foreign corporations owned by U.S. shareholders, which pretty much prevents the treatment of capital gain on a liquidation. You would probably be better to come up with some kind of a reorganization.
How can you do that?
Well, I don't know. You might be able to have the shareholders who wanted to get out sell the stock to the shareholders who wanted to get in. The sale of that stock. Now, if you didn't have a control, you could probably do that. If you didn't have a control, usually when you sell stock in a controlled foreign corporation, you can't get capital gain treatment on it. It's ordinary income treatment because you haven't been paying any tax on any of that corporation's income the whole time. The government does not then let you unload the stock at the capital gain rates. But if you don't have a controlled foreign corporation to start with, you might be able to sell the stock at capital gains rates and pay the capital gains tax. And you could create a loss in the same year on domestic markets. And that would take care of your problem. Assuming you're not going to have an enormous amount of gain, you know, over a period of 1 year.
This may be repetitious. Sorry. If the corporation that the gentleman was describing, say their business was a commodity business in London, would that be subject to the gain dividend theory?
Yes, it would. Trading in commodities futures anywhere. What do you mean by cash market? You're trading cash? Then I would say that's trading in goods, and that would not be subject to the deemed dividend theory. Anywhere.
Now, you don't need 10 people to do that.
No, as long as you're dealing, you only use 10 people to avoid controlled foreign corporation treatment all the time. If you can get 10 people, that's the best way to do business. Because then you don't have to worry about the deemed dividend theory. You don't have to worry about anything if you have more than 10 people. That's right. I mean, as a practical matter, it's hard to find 10 people who are going to go into a foreign corporation and who are going to stick it out. And usually you are faced with the fact that you are a controlled foreign corporation. Usually you do have more than 50% control in U.S. shareholders. And so it's only when you are faced with the fact that you are a controlled foreign corporation that you have to deal with the deemed dividend theory. And that's when you have to start balancing your income and looking for the kinds of income which are not subject to the deemed dividend theory. Trading in the commodities themselves, I would say, would never be subject to the deemed dividend theory, although I don't know a case that says that. I just know that the law says that trading in commodities futures is subject to the deemed dividend theory. It doesn't say anything about the commodities themselves, so I presume that trading in commodities themselves is not subject to the deemed dividend theory. Yes, sir?
I understand that savings account interest is not subject to the
imposed tax. That's right.
What about TDs?
What are Treasury notes. The law says that for foreigners, interest on deposits held in U.S. banks is not taxable. Now, you are talking about a treasury note, which I don't think constitutes a deposit held in a U.S. bank. Again, I'm not sure whether the next words in that section of the code say, or treasury notes. I'm just not sure. I can find out this weekend if you want. I have my code back in my room if anybody wants specific answers. I don't travel without my Internal Revenue Code, which is too bad because it's about that thick. Yes, sir.
But a foreign corporation that otherwise would not be subject to U.S. taxation and who has no U.S. shareholders, would it qualify for U.S. taxation by participating in real estate partnerships that were limited to partners? Would that constitute making it...
As a limited partner? No, that's an investment, I would say. Certainly, limited partnership interests are treated as investments for every other purpose of U.S. law, securities laws, state laws dealing with partnerships. I would say that for tax laws, it should also be treated as an investment, subject to withholding. Income from that limited partnership paid to the foreign corporation would probably be subject to withholding because it would probably be a fairly periodic kind of income.
The point I was specifically trying to make is it wouldn't make that corporation then subject to overall U.S. tax.
Oh, no, certainly not. Oh, even if the corporation became subject to tax on the income of the partnership itself, the corporation would not be subject to tax on its income earned in other parts of the world. No, I'd say the IRS looks at each business activity that the corporation is carrying on in the United States, and it looks to see whether income is coming from each activity, and to the extent income is coming from that activity, it taxes it. Obviously, once the corporation has enough activities going on in the U.S., then the government just says, yeah, you're a U.S. company. Yes, sir. Well, there's a domestic international sales company. Yeah. A domestic international sales company is a domestic corporation, virtually all of whose activities consist of selling U.S. products overseas. Now, I didn't talk about that today because it takes about $50,000 in legal advice a year just to comply with the Domestic International Sales Corporation's rules, and it's not really a practical kind of vehicle for an individual. Most Domestic International Sales Corporations, which they call DISCs, works like this. Ford Motor Company is manufacturing automobiles in Detroit, and it sets up the Ford Motor Company Domestic International Sales Corporation, sells its products to its corporation for, you know, a dollar above cost, and then has the corporation, the Domestic International Sales Corporation, sell the products overseas for considerable profit. And there are special rules which say that, in effect, what it says is the DISC is only subject to tax on 50% of the income that it earns. That's about what it comes down to. But in order to be a Domestic International Sales Corporation, 95% of your income has to be income from foreign sales, which means you can't have too much investment income. Okay, 95% of your assets have to be assets devoted to the sale of goods in foreign markets. A DISC is usually an office in the headquarters of some big United States corporation. I've never seen individuals try to set up a DISC. It can be done. But if you just step outside of these guidelines for one day, then you don't qualify as a DISC and all the income becomes taxable immediately. Yes, sir?
50%, however, is
That's about what it is. The rules are so complicated that I don't fully understand them myself. The bottom line is 50% of the DISC income is not taxed until it's brought back to the United States, until it's repatriated, until a dividend is distributed to the shareholders. Well, one thing, the doctor's corporation was not a domestic corporation, it was a foreign corporation. And he didn't have to, therefore, he could have benefited from the DISC rules, you're right, not as much because 50% of his income would have been taxed. But he can avoid those DISC rules, all that you elect to be treated under the DISC rules, and he could avoid them altogether by not electing, and he could do better than that by incorporating offshore. Now, if it's incorporating offshore, well, they can, and they do. They do, but it's a controlled foreign corporation. But you're right, and they don't pay tax on a lot of the income they make offshore until they bring it home. You're right. In Puerto Rico, too. Do you want to set up a manufacturing corporation in Puerto Rico? If you like Puerto Rico, you know, it all depends on where you like to go with these things, what you like to do. If you want to set up a manufacturing corporation in Puerto Rico, you don't have to pay any taxes to the United States government at all. Hardly. Until you bring the money back to the United States. That's because Puerto Rico is trying to increase its industry. And the Puerto Rican governor comes up to the Congress every couple of years and beats on the table and says we need more tax shelters for Americans in Puerto Rico, and he gets them. And the Puerto Rican corporations are good tax shelters. But again, it's manufacturing. It's not the kind of thing that individuals usually get into.
What would you estimate the cost of setting up the AIM corporation?
Yeah, I don't know. I suspect it's about the same as the cost of setting up a U.S. corporation. There's going to be a workshop tomorrow on Bahamian corporations given by Adrian Day, and he'll be able to tell you all that. You know, the Bahamas has all kinds of laws. They say you have to have three Bahamian directors, but the bank officers are your directors. All kinds of things, which they set up these laws, and then they make it very easy for you to comply with them, which is good because from the U.S., government's point of view, it makes it look like it's a bona fide corporation, which it is. I would say, you know, $1,000 or two would suffice, which is about what it would cost. It wouldn't cost you that much in the United States, but you have more problems over here. But when you set up a foreign corporation, you should view it partially as a pleasurable thing. It should be something you do, you know, because you like to travel. You can't really run a full-time business from a foreign corporation. From the United States, if you have a foreign corporation, and it's unless you actually want to move to the Bahamas or to your tax haven country and live there, which is okay too. Yes, sir.
Foreign personal holding companies. How about signature authority over it? Can you have signature authority over it and yet retain any degree of anonymity?
Anonymity from whom?
Well, just general.
Well, if you're asking whether or not you have to report to the Department of Treasury the fact that you have signatory authority over a foreign personal holding company, I'd say you probably do. Yeah. Oh, I don't know. For failing to report your foreign bank account, I think the penalty is $5,000 or maybe it's $500 and a year in jail. If it's willful. Now, you know, very few people are even aware of the fact that they're supposed to report their foreign investment accounts. And I probably shouldn't have even mentioned it today because now what I've done is turn a bunch of people into some possibly willful violators of the reporting laws. Yes, sir.
Bank account. The beneficial owner of that bank account is a non-resident alien to the United States. You still have to report as a U.S. citizen.
Why? Who owns the bank account?
Non-resident aliens to the United States.
No, I don't think. I don't.
For
no, you wouldn't have to report that. It's only Americans. It's only U.S. citizens who have to file those reports with a.
I'm a U.S. citizen. I signed over. Ah. Bank account.
I see.
Well,
if you've signed it over to her, if you've given it to her, then you don't own it anymore. Is that what you're saying?
No. The account is hers, but she gave me an authority to sign over the account.
Ah. That's a question of fact. You know, I don't know. I suppose if you had the authority to draw on those funds at any time you wanted, if you had the authority to direct the bank or whoever was holding those funds to do things with those funds, if you possess sufficient incidence of ownership so that the IRS could prove that you really owned that account, regardless of what the paper said, then I'd say they'd treat that as a foreign account and you'd be required to report.
I think he has to. It would be just like if you are a director of
a subsidiary of an American company, which has foreign bank accounts, it has signatory powers. You have to send in one of those forms, and I think that's the same thing.
Yeah.
You have to report that you have signatory powers.
Yes, sir.
An American married to a non-resident alien, if she comes to the United States for a holiday, and she owns a separate foreign company and foreign bank account, how does the United States look at her?
Filing a joint return?
Filing any sort of return necessary to a...
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question. I would say, I believe the law says that citizens and residents of the United States are required to file reports on foreign bank accounts. If she's not a resident of the United States, for tax purposes, not for immigration purposes, then she would not be required to file the report. But if... What establishes residence? For IRS purposes? Oh, I don't know. There are a bunch of rules. I think more than 90 days in the U.S., is enough to create a presumption that you are a resident. Or maybe it's 120 days. It's a facts and circumstances test. They look at your connections. They look at what you do here, how much time you spend here, and they look at how much time you spend abroad. They look at where you own your property, where you keep your bank accounts. There are no set rules. I mean, their presumptions arise, but they can be rebutted if you can show that you don't really reside here. Yes, sir?
Does a foreign non-resident alien incur by trading of commodities futures in the U.S.?
I would say he was probably... I don't know. I'm trying to figure out whether that would be considered investment-type income. You see, the words they use to tax foreigners who are investing in the U.S. is determinable and periodic income. That kind of income is subject to withholding. As far as commodities futures, I don't think commodities futures falls into that crack.
How about capital gains? Short-term capital
gains? No, foreigners are not subject to tax on their capital gains.
But what you're saying, the maximum tax then would be a withholding tax?
It would be a withholding tax of 30% if it was not a treaty country, and 15% or maybe 5% if it was a treaty country. Yeah. Well, I'm familiar with it. Well, what happens is when you buy a straddle, you obviously when you straddle in commodities, you buy and you sell at the same time. Okay? The value of the commodity has to move one way or the other. And if it does, you're making money on one side of the straddle and you're losing it on the other. Suppose you bought at 10 and sold at 20. And the value of the commodity goes up to 15. All right, you're making $5 on the commodity that you bought at 10. You're losing $5 on the future that you sold at 20. It's a tax deferral. So what they do is they put you on this straddle, and then they look and they see what happens. And then they get you off the straddle on whichever side of it is losing money. And then they buy another straddle right away, so you're still protected against a margin call. In the meantime, it's a different piece of paper. So you have bought a piece of paper and you've sold it at a loss. And that loss, it's a capital loss, which can be used to offset any gains that you have. And a lot of times what somebody will do, somebody with a large short-term capital gain will do this to create a large loss. Okay? That will eliminate his gain for the year. And then he'll hold his commodity future contract that's making money. He'll hold it for more than 6 months, because you only need to hold commodity futures contracts for 6 months to realize long-term capital gain. And then he sells it, and he still realizes he's got the same amount of gain, but he's changed it from short-term capital gain to long-term capital gain by creating a capital loss in the meantime. There'll be a workshop on that tomorrow if you want to learn more about that. I will not be hosting it. No, a couple of guys from Conti Commodity, I think. Yeah, it's a man named Gene Jackson and Jake Bernstein. They are holding a workshop. I think it's tomorrow morning, and they're going to talk about the use of commodity spreads to. You can always defer income because you can defer taxation as long as you want because you can keep creating losses. You can defer it year after year after year if you want. But you can also convert a short-term capital gain into a long-term capital gain. So you actually reduce income when you do that. You reduce tax on income when you do that.